This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Imagine, it's a summer night in the 1970s, and LA's Griffith Observatory Planetarium is packed. But this crowd isn't here to see the Big Dipper. No, they're waiting for a different kind of spacey spectacle to begin. The laser light show, known as Laserium.
The atmosphere is one of a concert, but this time it will be a concert for the eye as well as the ear.
Pink Floyd plays on the speakers, while multicolored lasers trace circles and strobing patterns in time with the tunes. Remember back then? Well, today that iconic laser show may feel like a quirky 70s relic like macrame or disco. We take lasers for granted. Even your computer mouse has a cheap laser in it. But in the 70s, lasers were new and wondrous and seriously far out. And the Laserium, it had its origins in Dr. Elsa Garmeyer's physics lab. Here to tell the story is Dr. Elsa Garmeyer. She's the Junkins Professor of Engineering at Dartmouth College and a former president of the Optical Society. She joins us today from Hanover, New Hampshire. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Garmeyer.
Good morning or good afternoon, Ira.
And Patrick McRae is also with us. He's an historian at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and co-editor of a forthcoming book, Groovy Science. I love that title. He wrote about the Laserium on his Leaping Robot blog. Welcome back to Science Friday, Patrick.
Thanks, Ira. It's nice to be back.
Dr. Garmeyer, take us back. Take us in that Wayback Machine to the late 60s, the early 70s. Why were physicists like yourself so excited about lasers?
Well, the laser had a characteristic that no other light has called coherence, and that means that it sparkles. When you look at laser light reflecting off a wall, you see real sparkle, and that only comes from coherent light. It also would go in beams, much a bit like the old-fashioned carbon arc lamps that they used to have for Hollywood, but now these beams are small and beautiful.
And then I remember they could blow holes in razors. They used to describe it as how much Gillette power your laser had, remember?
That's right. The very first laser demonstrated was a ruby laser, and it put out a tremendous amount of power. It was completely unpredicted. And it was quite a surprise when it put out so much power that it could blow holes in materials, and it can even ionize the air.
Mm-hmm. Patrick, lasers had a cultural mystique too, right?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember, like Elsa was saying, that in the 1960s, lasers were very rare sorts of things that you would oftentimes just see in the laboratory. So one of the great things about Laserium was that it helped popularize the laser itself for a much wider audience.
Mm-hmm. And then Star Wars came in the 70s, and yeah, that made it big.
Exactly. Everybody wanted a lightsaber, including me.
Elsa, what got you thinking, hey, maybe I could make art with lasers?
There was an organization called Experiments in Art and Technology that started out with a combination of artists in New York and Bell Laboratories that put on a very famous event called Nine Evenings. And from that developed the opportunity to build a pavilion in Expo 70 in Japan. And I was asked to be a part of that because they had optics, and I'm an expert in optics, and they wanted me to work with them on building the world's largest hemispherical mirror, which we did.
And one of your early laser art experiments, I understand, required a trip to the bathroom plastics supply store. Please.
So having met some very prestigious artists from New York, I got to asking myself, if I were to be an artist, what would be the characteristics of lasers that I would want to use in my artwork? And I decided that they were pretty, and that was a characteristic that I liked. So I wanted to make beautiful patterns. And I discovered that if you put transparent materials that have some structure in them, like bathroom shower stalls that were popular in those days, you could make very beautiful patterns using the laser. In those days, the only cheap laser was a helium neon laser, And even that was $1,000. So it wasn't something you did in your house, really. But I could use the lasers from our laboratory at Caltech and experiment around, and I found a way to make these very beautiful laser patterns.
I understand that your super secret laser art technique uses Duco cement. Now, you have to be of a certain age to remember Duco cement. It's sort of like airplane glue, if I remember it correctly.
Well, believe it or not, it's still sold because I just got started making these laser light show pictures again. Suddenly people are aware of the time that's passed and they want them. And I found my old glue wouldn't work after 40 years. So I had to make new diffusers. And so I sent my husband off and he came back with some Duco cement so anybody could get it.
Patrick, how does laser art make the jump from Dr. Garmeyer's lab to the planetarium?
Yeah, that's a really interesting story. So one of the people who saw some of Elsa's work in Los Angeles was a man by the name of Ivan Dreyer, who had worked at the famous Griffith Observatory. And he originally showed up at Elsa's lab, and he wanted to film some of the laser images that she was producing. But he soon realized that filming these was inferior to seeing them in person. So Ivan and Elsa put together a company called Laser Images Incorporated, and riffing on the word planetarium, they called their product Laserium. And finally, after much perseverance, in November 1973, Ivan Dreyer had the chance to debut Laserium at Griffith Observatory, which was a huge success. Soon they were turning away hundreds of people every night.
Mm-hmm. And in the early days, laser shows were performed by laserists, right? What is a laserist? What does he or she do?
It's really interesting. I mean, the people oftentimes forget, but the laser show was actually a live show. There was a laserist, and he or she could actually control the beams and actually acted as a composer of sorts for each laserium show. So this person would sit at a console and sort of work a visual synthesizer. And the main laserium office would provide a master program for the laserist, but the person could then actually modify that according to the crowd's reaction, the kind of music they were playing, and as well as their own skill and imagination.
And the laserium became very successful around the country, didn't it? How popular was it?
Well, by 1976, already over 2 million people had seen shows, and planetaria in Los Angeles and Denver and San Francisco and Chicago all had places where you could see it. And the music, of course, was a huge part of the appeal. I mean, you opened the segment with some Pink Floyd, I believe. But interestingly enough, it was classical music that they first used at the early shows. In fact, the very first piece of music that played at the opening Laserium show was Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man. But gradually that shifted to Pink Floyd and Emerson, Lake and Palmer and some of the trippy prog rock of the 1970s.
Elsa, were you prepared for how big this got?
Well, I'll tell you, I loved it. I loved the classical music. And when they switched to the rock music, that's when I decided to absent myself.
Well, there's just so much Copland you can do. Patrick, what, did you react the same way? Or were you happy with the rock music?
I saw the first shows in the 1980s, and you know, I certainly enjoyed it. But I also probably wasn't as chemically enhanced as some of those people in the 1970s were when they saw some of the Pink Floyd shows.
I like the way you phrased that, as chemically enhanced. You've compared the laser light show to 19th century science demonstrations. Why do you make that connection?
Yeah, it's interesting that Laserium debuted at a public planetarium because these, of course, have a long history of educating as well as entertaining people. And this tradition goes back all the way to the 19th century when there were public displays of electrical effects that people like Michael Faraday and Nikola Tesla would do with great flourishes and showmanship. And Laserium is sort of a continuation of that tradition that combined an educational component where people could see and perhaps learn about lasers as well as with the obvious entertainment value.
Mm-hmm. Elsa, tell us what your early Laserium photos, the pictures you were drawing, the images, what did they look like?
It's hard to describe them because they are unique, but they were a bit wispy. And the light gets spread out in a kind of a wispy pattern, but the pattern has structure as well. So it's something that is not really easy to explain if you haven't seen it. I have sent some of my Laserium photos to be able to go on the website that you guys have and are going to have up, so there is a way for people to look at them.
I understand you're making new laser art right now. Can we try this kind of stuff at home?
Yes, I did not patent my idea. I'm a great believer that people should do it. In fact, in 1971, I suggested that there could be a home laser light show, and I demonstrated it on television, but nobody wanted to buy it because the lasers themselves were not cheap. It would have been the equivalent of about $2,000 these days, and nobody was tripped out enough to spend that kind of money.
But now we have those little the pointers, those little red laser pointers are very cheap.
And so a red laser pointer and a green laser pointer is all you need. You can also get laser pointers in other colors. And if you send these lasers through, we call them diffracting materials. These are the transparent materials. They're clear, but they have patterns in them, they're usually plastic that have patterns. Or you can get a glass slide and put some Duco cement on it. And when you do that, it will get air bubbles, and the air bubbles will diffract the light. And that works as well. I did want to say, however, that many of the lasers that you can now buy on the web are dangerous. They're too powerful, and if you're a parent, you should be very careful about letting your kids just order lasers online without looking carefully to see if they're safe.
There you go. So you have a project to try at home. I'm going to try this. I have a laser light pen. I certainly know where my Duco cement is underneath all my airplane models. So I'm going to see if I can squeeze out a little blob of that stuff. Thank you both for taking time to be part of our program. It's been a real blast from the past, as we used to say.
And, excellent. Thanks, Ira.
Elsa Garmeyer, Junkins Professor of Engineering at Dartmouth and former president of the Optical Society. Patrick McCray is a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara, co-editor of the forthcoming book, Groovy Science. And if you want a real blast from the past, you can head over to our website at sciencefriday.com/laser. We've got lots of groovy pictures of the Laserium over there. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you've ever used Velcro, you know, to hold things together, like the flaps of your sleeves or camping equipment, you have benefited from the tiny hooks and burrs used to stick and stick and stick to your clothing. You've benefited from design inspired by nature, the cockle burr. That's how it was discovered. The cockle burr was the inspiration for Velcro. And when you fly in an airplane, you're benefiting from the structure pigeons' wings used to keep themselves aloft. Japan's bullet trains are inspired by the drag-resisting bill of the kingfisher. Did you know that? Maybe you're getting the picture now. Many engineering feats are really mimicry of successful designs in nature. What if we could make more efficient wind turbines using the fins of humpback whales as a guide, or mimic the barnacle-repelling skin of sharks to keep our ships and docks free of pests? What do you think? What animal or plant characteristic do you think we could benefit from? Give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, because we're going to talk with two engineers who work in the world of possibility. Robert Full is professor of integrative biology at the University of California, Berkeley. Also editor-in-chief of Bioinspiration and Biomechanics. His work looks at how geckos stick to walls, how cockroaches can run fast while squeezing through tight spaces. I've always wondered how they can do that. And who hasn't? And he thinks about how robots can use these innovations. And Hanrei Jiang is a professor of electrical and computer engineering at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And he has been working on an apparatus that could help people and machines see better in darkness with the help from the eyes of a lobster and a particular African fish. Boy, we want to get in to find out how all of this works. And as I say, our number again is 844-724-8255. Welcome, gentlemen, to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hanrei, you recently published a paper describing a way to make a more light-sensitive lens, starting with inspiration from a lobster eye.
Correct.
Tell us about that.
Well, the idea to improve the light sensitivity of an imaging system Most of the research right now predominantly focus on improving the electronics or the material of the imaging sensor. We were interested in a different complementary approach by collecting and guiding more light reaching the imaging sensor. So this would be a great method and has a huge benefit because it does not consume electronic power, electrical power. In our exploration, we were inspired by two types of very different natural eyes, those of lobsters and those of elephant nose fish.
And the lobster eyes, are, what advantage do they have? Are multiple, many small eyes instead of one big eye? Or is that the idea here?
Yeah, the lobster eyes, they fall into a category called the superposition compound eyes. Speaking of compound eyes, I think people are more familiar with insect eyes like fly eyes, dragonflies.
Right.
These are called apposition compound eyes. To put it simply, one small eye would correspond to one imaging unit, roughly speaking, one pixel. In superposition compound eyes, multiple small eyes would correspond to one pixel. So there's more light reaching each pixel, that's higher light sensitivity. However, the fabrication to realize such a man-made version of the lobster eye is very challenging. We did succeed a few years ago, but it was very, very hard because the three-dimensional structure and the intrinsic microscale features need to be very precisely arranged and made onto a perfect spherical dome. It's very intolerant of any imperfection.
Mm-hmm. You also worked with the elephant nose fish together. How did you work them two together to improve
the vision? That's where the elephant nose fish come into picture. So scientists discovered a couple of years ago that in the retina of elephant nose fish, there are some very intriguing microstructures that look like tiny funnels. They found that these structures can effectively collect and guide the light towards the photoreceptors. This is, of course, very interesting because optically, such design is much more tolerant of imperfection in the structures. So we combine the features of both eyes, the lobster eyes and the elephant nose fish retinas, two very different types of eyes, and then we came up with a microscale parabolic mirror array that performs superposition for light sensitivity for the image sensors.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Jiang, what got you so interested in looking at animal eyes in the first place?
I have always been fascinated by animal eyes. I think the natural visual systems have some very interesting, intriguing designs. They are, of course, well-suited for the specific animals, but these designs could be very useful for us to improve our man-made systems.
And Robert, do you agree? Why should we look to nature to solve human problems? Because nature may have some of the answers that we're looking for.
No, absolutely. I think nature can be thought of as sort of a library of wonderful design ideas that can inspire us to design really wonderful new and better things.
Mm-hmm. And because we don't have a copter, a quadcopter like that can maneuver like a hummingbird yet, right? None of our drones
not
can
yet.
Do that. Not yet.
Well, we're working on it.
All right, let's go through some of the examples of biomimicry that we might be using without even knowing it. I mentioned Velcro, right? That was a bird that was discovered. Was it George de Mestral or somebody like that, if I remember correctly?
Mm-hmm. Back in 1948, some of the plants got stuck to his dog, and he looked at them and invented Velcro.
And airplanes. The Wright brothers were looking at flying birds.
Yeah, they looked at turkey vultures, and they saw how they turned. And we now have the flaps on the wings called ailerons that help do that.
And Japanese bullet trains were helped by what?
So there's a kingfisher bird that dives into the water and has very low drag, and this train was making very loud noises as it was moving 200 miles an hour. And by studying the way that the kingfishers did, they were able to reduce that drag and sound.
I understand that lotus leaves have a connection to paint. Tell me about that.
Lotus leaves are incredible. So they're naturally self-cleaning, water repellent, and they've led to paints and sprays and over 200 patents because they're super hydrophobic with bumps and hairs and drops just collect dirt and just roll right off.
What are the limits of biomimicry? There's got to be a limit. Why isn't it enough to just copy what nature does?
Well, that's a really important question. I think that what we first have to realize is we can already do better than nature in many things. There's been a lot of large birds that have evolved, but none carry, 300 people across the ocean. No animal can move faster than a rocket or lift a beam to build a skyscraper. So we have to realize that we really want to integrate what the wonderful discoveries we find in nature are with the best human engineering. And after really 3.8 billion years of evolution, the organisms that are here really are not necessarily the best solutions that have been optimized. Organisms are not perfectly designed.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. You're saying basically that nature works just enough for what it needs, but not the best for that could be. We then
exactly.
take what nature has and try to make it even better.
Exactly. So natural selection is not engineering. Evolution works kind of on the just good enough principle and carries all the baggage of the past. And so you don't want to compromise things that in your design that are a result of the things that organisms do. They have to grow. Their parts do many things. They yeah. evolve from what they have. And engineers, though, can start from scratch. Biological evolution is kind of more like a tinkerer than an engineer. And tinkerers never really know kind of what they'll produce, and they use everything that they have to make something workable.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ray, let's talk about what else nature has that inspired your work. What inspires you from nature?
Sure, indeed. Lots of our work was inspired by nature. I'll give two examples. The first one, a few years back, we realized the tunable focus, liquid lenses in which a responsive polymer mimics the function of the ciliary muscle in human eyes to adjust the focus of the lens. In another work, we were inspired by sunflowers. We know that they can orient themselves throughout the day towards the sun to increase the sunlight interception. So we developed the light-sensitive polymers to actuate solar panels to track the sun for more electricity output. So those are just two examples.
Hmm. And you call your work bioinspiration rather than biomimicry. What is the difference there?
Right. I think Dr. Fu summarized it very well. I don't think we have to duplicate the natural systems all the time. A natural system, for example, an eye of an animal, it might be tailored for that specific animal, but it might not necessarily be perfect for our purpose. And second, we do have many capabilities to make things that the animals or plants are not capable of. So again, I think the key is to take advantage of both and combine the merits. I can give you an example. In the elephant nose fish's eye, the microfunnels work for red light. We don't necessarily have to limit ourselves to red light only. With a parabolic mirror structure that we realize, we can make it work for all visible light.
That's quite interesting. Let's go to the phones, 844-724-8255. First up, Reno, Nevada. Felice, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, how are you? Go ahead.
Great. So I've always noticed in looking at lacinato kale, the kale that's commonly used in salads but not the curly kind, it's incredibly water resistant, and I always had thought it would make really good outside weather gear, rain gear. Has anyone ever looked at the properties in that plant?
Robert, any comment?
I don't know about that plant specifically, but there's an enormous amount of work now on plants, the discovering the very kinds of things you're suggesting with respect to particularly new ways to harvest water.
Can you get a little more specific about
so
that?
So hairs, for example, are able to trap water out of the air and then collect them in droplets.
Yeah, because, everybody wants to harvest water. It's in short supply. What could be coming someday to our everyday lives? So, Robert, give us an idea.
In terms of...
I mean,
generally?
In generally. You like surfaces, I can see. You talk about fish and things like that. Skin?
Well, materials is a huge thing, of course, that we're able now to make things that, we just couldn't even conceive of before. And so the more our human technologies take on the characteristics of nature becomes a lot better teacher. For example, we can actually begin now to make something like spider silk. We can go from genes to the behavior, and this material is, stronger than steel and more elastic than rubber and softer than wool, and you can make all kinds of clothes or new bulletproof jackets or super durable seats or even artificial tendons.
Now, you've got to tell me, and I brought this up at the beginning, you've got to tell me the way cockroaches can run fast while pressed to the ground could give new capabilities for rescue robots? Is that what you could use them? Well, tell me how they do that and how you've imitated them.
So, you know, cockroaches are pretty disgusting, but they can tell us a lot of secrets. And so we wondered how they could infest virtually any space by going through these tiny little cracks using their skeleton. And we found that the American cockroach can compress their exoskeleton in half to slip through spaces that are basically the height of two stacked pennies. And they can do it in less than a second. And what was even more surprising is once we saw them inside the sort of vertically confined space, imagine two plates, one on top of the other, they continued to locomote really rapidly, even though they were compressed, so their legs were completely splayed out to the side. They could run at 20 centimeters a second, like 20 body lengths a second, which is equivalent to human size, the as fast as any sprinter, which means that it can not only squeeze in those tiny spaces in your house, but they can run at high speeds within your walls and ceilings.
It's disgusting me more. Let me just give everybody a chance to breathe a little second. Let me remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about biomimicry, and Robert Full is here to continue to talk about the wondrous cockroach. Well, go ahead. I'll finish up that story.
So we found that the cockroaches, we put them in a materials testing machine, and they can withstand a force nearly 900 times their body weight without any injury. So they're incredibly soft and robust. And so we looked at this, and from the discoveries on the cockroaches and how they squeeze through crevices, this inspired the design of a origami-like legged robot we called a CRAM, for compressible robot with articulated mechanism. And that in swarms, you could imagine them at some point helping locate survivors that have been trapped in tornadoes or earthquakes or explosions.
So they exist? You've made them?
So we've made a prototype robot that's able to go into spaces, compress in half, and still run at high speed.
Wow, the size of two coins stacked together?
That's what the cockroaches can do. Yeah. So it's incredibly small spaces.
But yours are just getting to that size.
So ours is about hand size, because we're thinking about also adding payload, some sensors that would be needed. But there are other groups working on ones that are just as small as the cockroach.
Henri, is there anything you would like to imitate that you haven't gotten to yet that you liked looking at?
In that sense, I have a very long list. There's so many things that I think Dr. Fu gave a very, very good example. Another thing that has always intrigued me, and actually not just me, I think every researcher is the brain. And of course, there's a huge initiative to reverse engineer the brain, how the brain processes the information, because it has always been fascinating. We take the information in, and our brain can process it and render all this information in a very logical way. And it in some aspects, it easily beats the best computer. And of course, on the other side, on some other hand, the computer obviously can do a much better job than our brain.
Right.
That would be one example I would really love to crack the code.
Robert, are there ways biomimicry can benefit us, even if we're not that interested in Velcro or your cockroach feet there?
Well, I think that it really is the only sort of alternative technology to our own. So in a way, looking at nature's designs can kind of free us from the constraints of our past design thinking and provide true innovation like you've heard about.
Well, we've got to conserve what we have out there, right?
I think this is a critically important point. So if we don't preserve nature's designs, then these secrets will be lost forever. So if these seemingly useless species disappear, we'll never know what we've lost.
All right, there you go. Good words for Earth Day today. I want to thank both of you, Robert Full, professor at the University of California, Berkeley, editor-in-chief of Bioinspiration and Biomimetics, And Hanrei Jiang is a professor of electrical and computer engineering at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. When we come back, have you ever seen a bullet shatter on impact? We're going to talk about this new foam made out of steel. It's amazing. It's a mind blower after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, metal foam. That's what I said. Think of a porous material like styrofoam, but made out of steel, aluminum, or another metal. We have a great video on our website of ballistic tests showing this material shattering and armor-piercing bullet shot at it. It's amazing. It just, boom, goes away. Go to sciencefriday.com/metal foam to see it. But metal foam has promises way beyond military applications. There's evidence that this same material could be used to minimize the damage in car crashes or shield spacecraft from heat and radiation, all kinds of things I don't think people have really thought about totally yet because it's so new. Here with details on this new space age material, as we used to like to say, is Afsani Rabi'i, and he is professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with the video of a bullet striking this metal foam. Describe what's happening there.
Well, we have a composite armor made out of our material with some front page and back page or back plate. And we do ballistic testing, all sorts of different impacts from type 3, type 4, which is the different sizes of bullet, and even 50 cal. And we were happily surprised to see that even the hardcore of the bullet is stuck in those bubbles that we had created inside the metal.
Why do the bubbles in the metal, in the foam, work better than just the plain old armor that we use today?
Well, if you look at the armors that people are using, normally people are looking at the back of the armor and provide something like a Kevlar to take care of the tensile force in the back. And the front part of the armor is where the compressive force is applied. For that, normally people are using either heavy steel or ceramic. Steel is heavy, and ceramic is also to some extent heavy, but the more important problem with ceramics is that they shatter in the first strike. So for the second strike, you have nothing. So we came up with the idea. I originally started making this material not necessarily for armors, but more for cars and trains to squeeze like a sponge, but in a heavy duty kind of form of a sponge. So we can put it in front of a car or high speed train and take care of the collision impact. But when we saw the performance of the material, we started thinking, how about ballistic and bullet? And so I tested those, and we saw that what you saw. So we saw that the material can perform. Basically, what we have here is a bunch of air bubbles that are embedded in the material. And when you hit that material, it will squeeze the bubbles, and by squeezing the bubbles, it will absorb the energy.
Huh, it's sort of like a balloon. You press it a little bit, and it sort of gives way until it bursts. So it absorbs the force of your finger. It's sort of counterintuitive to think that you're adding a lot of bubbles to the metal. That would make it stronger and able to resist the bullet penetrating further, or the egg. But that's how it works. Is there any secret to how you arrange the bubbles inside that make it better?
Well, actually, that is the main purpose, because I'm not the first person who ever made metal foam. There have been other studies where people blew air into a molten metal and create a metal foam similar to a bubble bath, but with a molten metal in the bath. Mm-hmm. Or adding some foaming agent, which is working similar to baking soda in a cake batter. But the problem with other metal foam has been, A, it creates a bunch of bubbles, or we call it porosities, or air pocket, that are in different sizes. They're randomly connected, and there's no structure to hold those bubbles. But our material has a very uniform bubble structure. There's no larger or smaller. So the load is, or the force is, uniformly distributed between all of those porosities. At the same time, we added some matrix to hold those bubbles together to work in force bearing or load bearing.
Yeah.
So as a result, the material has become the strongest metal foam, and it can perform well in loading or heating.
And not only, and I understand that it also can work in to be resistive to radiation in spacecraft. Would it block radiation coming in?
Correct. It can block the radiation, and the reason for that, and not only radiation but also heat, and the reason for that is the air that is trapped inside those porosities that provide the scattering of the radiation, as well as providing the heat to, heat, kind of provide a kind of heat shield.
Wow.
It's very similar to the cup that you hold beverage, hot beverage inside. So you have all those porosities inside the styrofoam, and
wow,
this is similar but in a metal form, so kind of more heavy duty.
Sort of a styrofoam metal. How soon are we going to see this? Are we going to see it showing up anywhere in actual use?
Well, I'm working on it, believe it or not. I'm working on it from both aspects, research, and I'm hoping that we can bring in investors and business people, because I'm by no means not a business person, so I'm a scientist. But I definitely welcome.
I can see DARPA. I can see all kinds of people trying becoming interested in this. I want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us today, Avsani.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Avsani Rabi'i is professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at North Carolina State University, right there in Raleigh. These days, our phones are the key to all our digital data. Crack the password, you get instant access to bank accounts, emails, all sorts of personal information. But how can we build a better password? You know, that's what we're talking a lot about with phones, the best kind of password. Well, the future personalized password might be right inside your own body. Smartphones, think of it, they have print fingerprint scanners. Companies have been looking at everything from retinal scans to heart rhythm trackers. But what about your brain? Your brain has a lot of electrical stuff going on there. Brain prints, using your brain waves as an identifier. Harder to hack than a fingerprint. And researchers at Binghamton University are studying how you could create these brain prints. My next guest is part of that team. Sarah Laszlo is an assistant professor of psychology at Binghamton University in Binghamton, New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Wow, brain prints. How do you create a brain print?
Very carefully.
You stole my line.
Yeah, sorry. What we do is we bring people into our lab, and we connect a bunch of sensors to their head so we can non-invasively measure their brain activity. And then we show them a whole bunch of images, rapid fire, one after another. And each of the images is sort of designed to elicit a very unique response from person to person.
Mm-hmm.
And once we have about a half an hour worth of their brain data, we can submit that data to a computer, and then the computer is able to sort of process the brain data and then figure out who is who.
So if you showed me a picture, I would have the same brain print all the time.
We don't use a single picture because the response to any single image, it changes too much and it's too noisy. So we use an average of about between 25 to 50 pictures.
And how accurate has this become?
100%.
Let me hear that again. I've never heard anything work 100%. You know,
I know. It's 100% accurate in a pool of 50 people to a period of up to 10 months, and that's the limits that we've pushed it to so far.
Well, you know, when you have anything like this, and you say it works 100%, immediately the hackers in the room are going to say,
"Oh yeah,
I can break that."
Absolutely.
So I guess part of your job then is to try to figure out the weakness.
Yeah. So immediately, immediately as soon as we got it to work, like the very next lab meeting was, okay, we got it to work. Now how do we hack into it? And so we're trying a whole bunch of different hacks. The engineers on the team have some computational hacks they're working on, but I'm not one of the engineers. I'm a psychologist. So the hack that I've been working on is the trying to figure out how possible it is for a malicious person, a hacker, to train their brain to impersonate the brain activity of someone else to sneak into a brain biometric system.
It's sort of like changing your fingerprints or your face or something, but you're changing your brain.
Yeah, so it's sort of the brain equivalent of maybe putting on a fake latex fingerprint to fool a fingerprint scanner.
And how easy is it then?
It's not easy. So far, we have trained, we call them our brain hackers. We have given them up to 12 hours of brain hack training, and we've only gotten them to be able to become about 10% more similar to their target than they were when they started. And they need to get to be about 40% more similar on average than they started. So it's 12 hours isn't enough, at least.
Mm-hmm. Does my brain print change over the course of a day if I'm hungry or sleepy or cranky or something else?
It probably changes a little bit, but the computer algorithms that we use are sophisticated enough that minor fluctuations don't break the identification system. And like I said, that is true up to a period of 10 months. So even though your brain activity obviously changes day to day, at least for a time span of that long, it doesn't change enough to break the computing system that identifies people.
Now, with 100% accuracy, where do you go from here?
I know. I kept telling my grad student, I don't know what you're going to do now because you're never going to be able to beat yourself. But most of it is towards trying to make the system that acquires the brain data cheaper and faster now.
So, yeah, okay, give me a setup of how you collect. Do I have to put that cap on with a lot of electrodes and things? Before you get that answer, let me remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about brainwaves and brain prints with Sarah Laszlo. She's an assistant professor is that SUNY Binghamton or is that the University of Binghamton? Binghamton
University? It is a SUNY, but they tell us that we should call it Binghamton University.
I went to SUNY Buffalo, and so I can call it SUNY Binghamton if you don't mind.
You can call it whatever you want.
Okay.
But I will get in trouble if I call it anything but Binghamton University.
Yeah, I know they do the same thing in Buffalo. So tell me, is it a cap, one of these typical things with all the wires coming out that we see?
Yeah, right now it is. And so one of the challenges is to make it not like that, because, of course, nobody wants to put that on every time they want to get into their computer. So one of our prototype devices that we're testing has the sensors embedded in Google Glass. So you just put the Google Glass on and it has the sensors in it, and then it does the identification in the onboard processor on the smartphone that the Google Glass is paired with.
Just with the Google Glasses?
Yeah, with the Google Glasses.
So you don't need the whole brain, you just need a part of the brain.
That's right. Even with the data we collected with the whole head worth of sensors, we found that we only needed about 5 of them in order to get the 100% accuracy.
And which part of the brain do you stick this Google Glasses around?
So the Google Glasses just go on like Google Glasses normally would. So when we do that, the active sensors are sort of over the temples. The sensors that we used in the published study with 100% accuracy were placed over the back of the head. So that's one of the challenges with the Google Glass, is that it only gives us access to the front of the head, and that's not where the best sort of classification data came from.
But you see what you've done here. You've given Google Glass a reason to be reinvigorated.
A reason to live.
Yes.
Yeah, I know.
You should be hearing from Google like in 5 minutes, I would think.
I was at Google in September or October, actually.
You're way ahead of me on this one.
Yeah, or they are. They're pretty smart over there.
Yeah. So I mean, if you can get Google Glass to come up with a way of, you know, identifying
That would be the greatest miracle, is finding something to do that's useful with Google Glass.
And just think, have you started a company or anything? If you're going to start talking business, is SUNY going to be involved in this?
We do have one patent that exists, and we have another one that's pending. But we haven't started a company yet. We're scientists, and so we don't know how to do that.
That's where the lawyers come in, you know.
Yeah, and fortunately, SUNY does have a lot of good lawyers that are there to help us out, and they've been very helpful.
So we might see this bearing fruition, you know, not too. I mean, you must have competitors, right?
We're the first lab worldwide to accomplish 100% brain biometric accuracy with the particular technique that we use. So not really.
Wow.
Which is nice.
So you're just sitting back and waiting for something new to happen now.
Yeah, we're sitting back and waiting to find out whether the NSF is going to give us more money. That's what we're really waiting for.
No, that would be small bucks compared to what Google could.
That's true.
I can see why.
That's absolutely true.
You're going out there. You know, is there anything, you know, physically that you could hack into? The Google Glass, if not the brain?
Yeah, so you could hack into, of course, the computer that is holding, say, the reference brain prints, and you could alter, say, the target's reference to be your own reference, or you could steal the reference so that you can feed it back into the computer. Those kinds of hacks are the things that my collaborators in engineering are working on, and I only know what they've told me about that.
Yeah.
But apparently, we have a paper that they're preparing where they've used some techniques from image processing, in particular steganography, to be able to identify when a sort of reference brain print has been stolen and fed back into the system. And they're about, last time I checked, they're about 70-80% successful in identifying that kind of attack.
So you've got a paper that's coming out, being published?
That one, yeah, the steganography paper is in preparation right now.
Okay, this is quite exciting.
For me, yeah. Long.
Yeah, well.
Thank you.
For all of us who have the Google Glass lying in the drawer somewhere. So.
I know. That's where ours lays most of the time.
All right. We're all on this together. Thank you, Dr. Laszlo, for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And good luck. That was quite interesting. Sarah Laszlo is Assistant Professor of Psychology at the State University of New York at Binghamton, or as they like to say, Binghamton University. That's about all the time we have for today. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And on the web this week, did you know that the U.S. has a chief data scientist, the first one ever? And we talked with the head honcho himself, DJ Patil. Check him out at sciencefriday.com/data scientist. You can email us at scifry@sciencefriday.com. Have a great weekend. Happy Passover if you're celebrating. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.